Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from utility bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov. And The Lyric Stage, presenting The Drowsy Chaperone. This bubbly love letter to musical theater includes mix-ups, mayhem, and a wedding or two. Now through May 12th at Lyric Stage Boston. Tickets at lyricstage.com.
At siennafarms.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Marjorie, I don't know if you caught that last line from Markey, from Senator Markey. I'm on the committee that has, quote, control over time. Wow, that's pretty heavy, don't you think?
I think that's very heavy.
So, excuse me, Jim. Thank you. Excuse me, waiter. There's a COVID spore in my soup. Restaurants, yes, have fully reopened in Massachusetts. At least they're permitted to this week. And yet food service workers still are not eligible for vaccines. Should we really be playing restaurant roulette? Joining me online to talk about this, if having robots enter the food service industry is one way to stop the spread, and other stories at the intersection of food policy, food culture, and robots, is Corby Kummer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey there.
Hello, Corby Kummer. So let's start with what Jim was talking about, the restaurants. Should restaurants be opening here and elsewhere?
If they follow the Aspen Institute's safety first rules and diner code of conduct and restaurant pledge, which we are feverishly revising for a big release in about 2 weeks with Jose Andres, our favorite World Central Kitchen. I'm not being facetious. There are a lot of conditions under which, if they're really careful about ventilation, getting in fresh air, exchanges of fresh air, constant vigilance about masks, and we have a new co-sponsor, One Fair Wage, which has been very good about server suggestions. For instance, anybody who seats you should be the person to say, while you are at the table, mask on at all times, especially when a server approaches your table. So there are lots of ground rules for safety that can improve this. But I would say, you already said, the most important thing is getting workers vaccinated, making restaurant workers high priority groups for vaccination. And the sooner they can get vaccinated, the safer it will be for everyone. Also, one thing we're being super careful, and Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen was very vocal about this as we're revising these new rules, is even if you have been vaccinated, there's no two-class system. You have to wear your mask. You have to observe all the rules as all the other diners. So there are a lot of safety ground rules that have to be observed in this new era.
Except that, you know, not that I've been running around to restaurants willy-nilly, but I have been a few times enough to know that people aren't wearing their masks. I mean, they might remember to put them on when the waiter comes over to the table, but they're eating, they're drinking, they're maskless.
Only if a restaurant is able to keep 6 feet from chair back to chair back. That's a rule we're also being very careful about. And change ventilation. And we are very good about saying just how high barriers should be, plexiglass barriers, portable cheap barriers, and we have sources for them. So if there's real space between the tables, barriers that are careful, or some of these outdoor cabins, if they change the air and they're really separated, that's the safest. But you're right, Marjorie. People are not good about wearing their masks. And restaurant staff don't want to enforce the rules because they'll lose out on tips, which is why having the host or having a manager or someone who is not directly serving the table should lay down the law at the beginning.
You know, by the way, just a quick note on that. One of the reasons why Governor Abbott's behavior is so despicable, in addition to putting everybody at risk in his state in Texas, is he puts the individual employee and or owner of a restaurant, a retail shop, or whatever, he or she has to be the enforcer of good public health behavior that is different from the direction being given by the chief executive. At least in Massachusetts, even if you're not crazy, the restaurants are at 100% capacity. Governor Baker knows that the mask mandate has got a hold, so it does. Speaking of Texas, though, I have to say, I can't say I almost wept, but this story about this Texas grocery chain that I never heard of, which is weird considering they have like 300 and some stores, virtually all of which are in Texas, was so moving in a cruel time. Can you describe, first of all, do you know about this chain before, and then describe it to us?
Of course I do, Jim.
Of course
Where
you
have
do.
You
I'm
been? So it's called H-E-B, and it's for H.E. Butts, who was the founder. And no jokes on the name in Texas. It is much loved. So one of the nation's yuppiest boutique grocery stores, which is why I know about it, is called Central Grocery in Austin, home of the headquarters of Whole Foods. But Central Grocery mounted like better cooking programs. Just they spent a fortune on really good ingredients, really good service. They were the Wegmans of Texas. Everybody like wanted to go to Central Grocery. And H-E-B, it has enormous brand halo. Why? Because in times of crisis when there's no power, as their Texas grid was lost in the recent storms, there they are with bread and peanut butter and milk and eggs and, you know, the French toast storm buying that we all are careful about. Supermarket chains, if they've got good supply chains and they have labor policies that will encourage labor to come in and brave the elements, can get enormous goodwill. So, Jim, you were very moved by this story in Texas. Do you all remember post-Katrina in New Orleans? Only Walmart was open, and they became the community center. They bought themselves a tremendous amount of goodwill by being there when city and government services were not. And that's the case with H-E-B during the recent Texas power outages.
You know, beyond the fact that they've, you know, had these supplies available for people, it's one of the great lessons to me about how treating your workers well is not only the humane thing to do, but it creates a client base that is huge. When you read the quotes, the things that were so moving in the story were people saying, you know, when literally, and I don't have it in front of me, but things like when government fails me or has failed me, you know, as they did in this debacle in Texas, I knew that H-E-B would be there for me.
Yeah.
I mean, there's these endless series of quotes that you can't believe aren't
manufactured. Yeah, one of the things I loved was, I'm homeless, so it's tough to find things cheap to eat, Mr. Saul 43 said. We've got to buy things easy to open, a lot of pop-tops. I don't like going to convenience stores because they're so expensive. So an endorsement from somebody who's homeless who relies on them.
And they talk, and some of the other quotes talk about how beautifully and warmly and humanely treated they were by all the workers. So, you know, it's just, it's a beautiful story. People should Google it. It's really great because everybody, maybe people aren't living through the Texas nightmares, but they're living through other ones. And it really speaks to how beautiful and important and valuable and profitable, if I may, treating other people decently in the commercial world.
Is. Like people who work for you.
Exactly. That's exactly.
Let's segue
right to
another beautiful story. It's a story about the rules and regulations.
Best story of the month.
For Purell and opening a Diet Coke. The extensive pages that were devoted to how the President of the United States had to be waited on in the Trump Hotel. This is unbelievable. This person deserves a Pulitzer Prize.
So this person is named Jessica Sidman, and she's a longtime and very good reporter for Washingtonian, the city magazine of Washington, which is still independently owned by the same family that's owned Washingtonian for like two or three generations. So they have a big local profile, and Jessica Sidman got the dirt on the servers at BLT Prime, which was the restaurant in the Trump Hotel. We all recall that Jose Andres was set to open in that beautiful old post office building, Renaissance Revival, right by the White House. And as soon as on the campaign trail, Trump started saying that the Mexicans were rapists and criminals coming across our border. Jose Andres pulled out, broke his contract, won a lawsuit, we assume, because it was settled out of court. But in any case, BLT Steak went in. I slammed it in a Vanity Fair piece about Trump wine. It was the only place that served Trump wine in Washington. And I went and I said it had the grim bonhomie of Maxime's in occupied Paris. I'm quoting myself because I like that line. But here is a disturbing fact before we get into the absurd lengths to which the servers had to go. They uniformly talked about high wages and being treated well. I was very upset to see this at the Trump Hotel. They would also be vilified, we all think rightly, on the subway, on the T, when they came home with any kind of Trump branding on their T-shirts, because everybody would say traitor. One worker was Latino and lived in a large extended family. They stopped talking to him even in his own house, because he worked for Trump Hotel, so we all go, yay. And when you look at the manual, the guide for the Diet Coke regime of having it with and without ice on two separate trays, of the incredible behavior, but wait for this, when Trump saw that somebody else at his table got a slightly bigger steak than he did, the chef caught hell, and so he started ordering. He had already ordered jumbo shrimp that only the president got.
Right.
So he had to have bigger shrimp than everybody else, because he always has shrimp cocktail. And he started ordering tomahawk steaks, you know, which cover an enormous platter, so he would never suffer again.
40 ounce. That is absolutely enormous. I love the instructions, though, on the Diet Coke. The moment the president sat down, apparently he had to be handed discreetly a mini pure bottle of Purell. This is before the pandemic. And then the next thing they had to do is, Mr. President, would you like your Diet Coke with or without ice? And then a polished tray with chilled bottles and highball glasses was already prepared for either response. So whatever way they could go. And then he had to pour. Apparently, the beverage had to be opened in front of the germaphobe commander-in-chief, never beforehand, with a long-neck bottle opener held by the lower third of the handle in one hand. And the Diet Coke also had to be held in the lower third in the other hand.
And he had to hear the pop of the mini ketchup bottle.
That's right.
And this is our super spreader in chief, who couldn't have been more reckless and worse about making himself and everyone around him ill.
I want to share more of the details from this brilliant story. Before I do, by the way, our relatively new coworker, Mackenzie, just to follow up on our HEB story, said her younger sister worked at HEB during the beginning of the pandemic, said they're a great company, so she's personally
vouching for it.
There you go.
And we're getting a lot of corrections on social media. It is not Central Grocery, Corby Cummer. It is Central Market. I want to make that clear.
Never again.
Never again. So let's just stay with this for a minute. So in addition to everything else, Corby and Marjorie said, which is great, as the piece says, don't forget the snacks. This I thought was a joke.
Unbelievable.
A tray of junk food needed to be available for every Trump visit. Lay's potato chips, specifically sour cream and onion, Milky Way. This is not possible. Milky Way, Snickers, Nature Valley granola bars, Tic Tacs, gummy bears, Chips Ahoy, Chips Ahoy, Oreo, Nutter Butters, whatever they are, Tootsie Rolls, chocolate covered raisins, and Pop Secret. And they go on to say, I want to say one good thing about him.
How does he not explode?
What? The good thing is, unlike his wife, who would send things back, the one thing he did not do, which I'm serious, I want to praise him for, because my father was the worst at this, and they humiliated me. It was so horrible. He would complain, but he would not send things back, which is a good thing. They also go on in the story talking about the whole circle of Trumpistas. And who do they select? They mentioned the MyPillow guy.
MyPillow man.
Used to hang out there. Who do they say was the worst of the Trumpians who would frequent the restaurant? Who did they say?
Think Rudy dripping Giuliani. Black hair dye.
Rudy Giuliani, yes. He'd plop himself in there, sometimes using his table as his workstation for the day. 10 hours. Let me just tell you, this story.
Yeah, a plaque. Had a plaque that read Rudolph W. Giuliani, private office.
You got to read this. As Corby said, it's in the Washingtonian.
But again, what you're saying, Marjorie, is they had to pander to these fragile egos.
They did.
Absurd over-deference. Trump worried that somebody else had a half ounce steak bigger than him. Remember the chocolate cake
bigger
at the White House, where he had to get somebody else's chocolate cake? This childishness is
appalling. You know, but it does sort of undermine all our healthy eating things. I mean, you got to say, the guy, what is he, 73 or 74? Yeah. Looks pretty good for somebody 73 or 74.
He's obese.
Well, he may be heavy, but he doesn't seem to lose much energy.
That's because he doesn't exercise. He doesn't use it up. And as a former female manager puts it, quote, I always try to dress like a Fox News anchor. This is one of the best stories, really. And by the way, 90% of the details we don't even have time for. Every one of the employees felt that whenever asked the question about Trump, they had to say, even if they had contempt for him, we love you.
He's a
great
guy.
We love him. When workers were coming to work on the metro and they were, you know, wearing their Trump hotel or whatever stuff, people would say, F you. They'd give them the finger. I mean, the whole, it is just.
It's a great story.
It is a
Pulitzer
great,
Prize.
Great.
Jessica
I think this
Sidman
is one,
should get prizes for it.
Absolutely. I absolutely think so. It's absolutely fun. I mean, it goes into the MyPillow guy and the Mnuchins and his wife, and she's bringing her little dog to eat at the place as well.
You know what's interesting, by the way, speaking of Trump hotels, Corby, I don't know if you saw this, that today, not today, yesterday was the day when there was to be the resurrection of Donald Trump, you know, according to QAnon and the other nuts. And they mentioned that March 4th, because that was the original inauguration day, they mentioned, as some reporter, I think for the Washington Post, but it may have been CNN, surveyed all the hotels in town. All the hotels on March 4th of this year were underbooked. What's the one hotel that was booked to capacity?
Trump International.
Trump
and it's the last time they're trying to unload it. The business is so far down that it's
and
losing a ton
up
of money.
The prices too, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're trying to get $500 million for it. Apparent real estate investors say nothing like it. You're never going to get anything like that.
So when we do go back to the station, Marjorie, when you do, you know, we pretty much help each other with the microwave and the little fridge we have.
Yep.
When you were kind enough to go get me a seltzer, could you hold the bottom third when you bring it back in if you don't mind and don't open
you know
the
what's
key
amazing for such a germaphobe, he was able during this pandemic. Now he was not close to people, but he wasn't that far apart.
He shook hands. Oh, during the pandemic, you mean?
Yes,
yeah.
During the pandemic, and yeah, right. Not the shaking hands, but the being close to these mad, yeah, massive crowds of people. You wonder. I mean, he did get COVID, but you do wonder how he didn't get it like the first day out with his interacting with all these thousands of people with
the
no
one good line of the irresponsible Debbie Birx, who deserves to be vilified for her irresponsibility. Was she would wear her mask during all Zoom meetings right in the White House, and she said, I am in possibly the one region of the United States that has herd immunity.
I never heard that line.
It was off the record, and I've just repeated it.
That
because
is
so
a
many
great
people
one.
There got COVID.
Of course. That is a great. She should be ashamed of herself, though. So, Corby, robots are apparently coming to a restaurant near us. This the story we started with today, and I'm not terribly troubled by this, even though I'm not a pro-robot kind of guy. I'm actually like humans for the most part. That at Bridgewater State College, I guess because of the pandemic, they bought a ton of these little tiny robots that deliver for a small fee. I think it's $1.99 or something like that. Deliver food to your dorm room or wherever you are. Now, in light of the fact that you are probably the ultimate defender of the dignity and quality of the human beings who work in the food service industry, I assume you're appalled. Is that a fair assumption?
I'm very disturbed. I'm super disturbed. First of all, I showed it to a young coworker a year and a half ago when UC Berkeley started having pizza delivery robots on campus. Oh, so that was one of the first campuses. Apparently, Sodexo, the enormous food service operation, has been buying these robots and deploying them on various campuses. And my young colleague said, this is dystopian. This is so gross. And when you look at this, and by the way, they have come to a restaurant near me. There's a restaurant up the road from where we live that has these robots, three or four of them, and delivers food. So they are kind of cute when they come down the street, but the fact that so many people quoted at Bridgewater State University College as saying, ooh, they're cute, and if they get caught in the snow or they fall on the curb, I send a snapshot and I upload it because I want them to be rescued. This bonding with these robots, meanwhile robbing workers of wages who desperately need them because there's so little business at colleges, this is very alarming.
So if you were to write what Landau wrote about Bruce Springsteen, I've seen the future, and it is... Is this the direct? I mean, obviously, you know, $550 a robot is a pretty cheap investment compared to a human server. Is this where we're going, even if it's only as a supplement to, you know, you have a primary server who can take care of many more customers. And after he or she takes your order, the food is delivered by the machine. Is that, I mean, that's...
Well, first of all, on campuses, it's antisocial. It's encouraging this isolation of students eating in their rooms.
That's a good
point. This is a big problem. It's not, I don't fault universities because they can't mount dining halls. Yale University, which I've just been writing about, actually has these X-shaped plexiglass barriers. They limit foretops. So at every foretop, you're in what looks like a prison isolation booth. And that's the only way you can talk to your fellow diners.
Foretop means a table that would allow four people to sit there.
Right. So it's square, and yeah. You can imagine this X, these cross plexiglass barriers, and they go up like 6 feet above the table.
Wow.
And nobody wants to be in them, unsurprisingly. But they spent the money. Most colleges are not spending that money. They'll never get it back. And students aren't even using it. Okay, so colleges are kind of excused for robots. The only excuse I can see is saving Grubhub and DoorDash and these unbelievably greedy delivery services, which are gouging restaurants. If restaurants could use them economically, I think it's a 1.5 mile radius is the maximum that these robots can manage. And they were able to pay their workers more because they weren't being gouged by the delivery services. Then I can imagine excusing them.
Mark, are you troubled by this? You've been silent, which makes me nervous.
About the robots?
Yeah. Don't tell me it's okay with... Don't say it's okay with you.
Well, you know...
Don't say it.
They're kind of cute. I mean...
They're not kind of... And they're going to be robot radio talk show hosts next, Marjorie. So let's see how cute they are then.
And they're going to synthesize your voice, Marjorie. So they're going to be able to be you.
I mean, you can see them. They got the little antennas coming up on the sides. The little starship is a little name. I mean,
you're falling for them.
She is.
I didn't like that Marty that was in the grocery store.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Marty in a minute.
In the
hey,
Stop
Corby,
and Shops looking weird.
As always, a wonderful time. Pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so
and
much.
You.
Be well.
Thank you, Corby. Corby Kummer joins us every week. He's the Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Thanks a lot, Corby Kummer. Coming up, as Jim said, are you ready for the robot revolution? Apparently, they're coming. This is 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Domestic work.